This is FM 100.5 and 101.9. AM 1450, Rutherford County's place to talk. WGNS, Murfreesboro, your good neighbor station. This is The Truman Show with Truman Jones. A look at the politics, news, sports, and people that are shaping Rutherford County. Now your host, Truman Jones.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, I'd work for all my life, and I had to start again with just my children and my wife. I thank my lucky stars to be living here today, 'cause the flag still stands for freedom and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free, and I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today, 'cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA. From the lakes of Minnesota to the hills of Tennessee, across the plains of Texas, from sea to shining sea, from Detroit down to Houston and New York to LA, well, there's pride in every American heart, and it's time we stand and say, proud to be an American, where at least I know I'm free, and I won't forget the men who died, who gave that right to me. And I gladly stand up next to you and defend her still today, 'cause there ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA. There ain't no doubt I love this land. God bless the USA.
And what a way to do an introduction. I mean, if you can't stand at attention and have little things crawling down your back that just makes you so proud to be an American, there's something wrong with you. And you know, we have Mr. Greg Tucker on. Of course, everybody knows that every other Tuesday. It's his show, and I get to sit back and just enjoy myself and listen to all the great stories. And I had the honor of introducing you the other day when you spoke at the mayor's prayer breakfast, and did such a great job. And
I appreciate that you did leave me a few minutes of my time.
Yes, I did. Well, I'm kind of bashful, so I don't like to stand up there very long. But you were your main topic, of course, what was religion and the churches in the community, mm-hmm. and how far we go back with a lot of those churches. And it's amazing to me that those churches are a lot of them are well over 200 years old.
Yeah, religion traces as far back as settlement of this area. It mm-hmm. really does. Some of the earliest people in the area were the particularly the Baptist missionaries and the Methodist circuit riders. They were working this area as, how would you say, very fertile ground in that early period. And I'm sure many of us remember that religion, it's true today for many of us, but back then religion was one of the most important, and I don't mean to be at all irreverent, but it was an important type of recreation. This is when you got together with your friends, with your neighbors, you know, during the hard week, 6 days. You pretty much back then were working your place, but come church time, you know, people got together. And the preachers, the circuit riders, and the missionaries were entertainers. And I'm sure this is still true to some extent today, but, you know, people went to be... to enjoy themselves and to leave with a good feeling.
And you still do that up to a point, but it doesn't become one of your major days of, like you said before, entertainment and food on the ground.
Socializing.
It was just a special time when you didn't get to see everybody. So that was your one day to just to socialize and have a good time.
Well, our focus last week was on the Murfreesboro Bicentennial and the churches in Murfreesboro. But you get out in the county, and there are still a few, but several congregations that predate anything that's here in Murfreesboro. And that's as a result of the, as I said, the Baptist primarily. And I said during my talk, I said, now I'm talking about the original Baptist, because the Baptists, like other groups, have divided and split and argued, and now we have different kinds of Baptists. But the original missionary-type Baptists were all of a single thought, and that was getting out into the frontier areas and converting people to their beliefs and establishing congregations, which would then persist.
In many ways, that really hasn't changed a whole lot.
No, I don't think so. Obviously, the location and the type of people you're dealing with and the attitudes and interests of people have changed. But I think we're still spreading the word and trying to bring people to the church.
You're always spreading the word.
The Methodists were a little different. They were, and again, not to be irreverent, but remember, these guys were also making a living. I mean, the circuit rider, if he didn't successfully bring together a group in the local area where he was, he wasn't going to get fed, he wasn't going to get housed. So, you know, they would go in and spend weeks in one location having camp meetings, they called them, revivals, we'd call it now. And, you know, they worked very hard preaching and organizing, and in return, they were fed and housed and usually sent on their way with a little extra coin, a little extra change, so they could go on to the next place. So this was, from one point of view, a business. And
so they were actually full-time preachers back then.
The circuit
riders,
they
did not have careers of any kind other than that.
Oh, no, the circuit riders, that was their livelihood and their mission, very much so. And there were the different styles. I think the Methodists did spur the creation of, you know, permanent churches and the continuing things. The Baptists were more oriented that way. They were doing the missionary and working to organize. Circuit riders, frankly, expected to be back through there. And in the early days, the circuit riders area may not have an opportunity to, you know, hear the gospel preached except once every couple of months, because they had to wait for the circuit rider to come back through.
Now, we all have been in churches over the years where the minister, pastor, the preacher was not full time. They had they had business. I remember at Science Hill Church of Christ, where I was raised in, the I remember Brother Joe Netherland, and he was actually in the insurance business.
That's right.
But was really a great preacher. I mean, I loved to go because he was one of those that could bring the past and bring it up to where you were and can understand it even at my young age.
Well, out at Big Creek Baptist, which is where I raised my children, all of the preachers are what we call lay preachers. Mm-hmm. We had a roofer. We had an electrician over the several years there. And that's the primitive Baptist now. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of the missionary Baptists, the smaller, they're also lay preachers. And it's kind of interesting for me when we began making that our church, because I was raised in a Methodist, and the Methodists have a system of bishops who mm-hmm. make decisions as to who preaches where, and they will be assigned there for a period of time, and that's their career, mm-hmm. their profession. So, and I don't see that one is better than the other at all, but I can see how a very large urban church, you know, that could support a full-time, that's probably the better arrangement. But in order to be sure everybody has a good message on Sunday, that's why the lay preachers are very important.
You know, the differences, as you were saying, are quite small when you look at the differences, say, yeah. a Methodist, Presbyterian, Church of Christ, Baptist, all the way down yeah. the line. You just have a few little things that separate them all together,
right.
but yet they still are able to command a fairly good amount of people in each church.
Well, you remember as I began my remarks, I noted how when you and I were young, very young, back in the 1950s, mm-hmm. would we have even given any credibility at all if someone had told us, well, in 1980, right here in Westview on the corner across from McFadden School, there's going to be a Buddhist temple?
No.
You know, in fact, we probably would have said, what's Buddhist?
That's right. I didn't know what a Buddhist
and
temple
probably
was.
Probably would have even said, what's Laotian? Because
right.
it was the Laotian community that started it. Mm-hmm. Chanto Sorinho, in my opinion, the patriarch of that community,
right.
Was there at the prayer breakfast. And then beyond that, the diversity in the area now is just would have been beyond anybody that I knew. Ability to imagine. I mean, that we would have the diversity that we now have in this area in terms of religious diversity.
But it's made such an impact on this community. It really has.
It has, and I think as time moves on, we'll ultimately all agree that it's been a positive impact, and certainly we can see evidence of that now. And if we go back in time, we can see how a lack of a confidence and understanding and kind of always the resistance to change or something new, because mm-hmm. when the Catholics first were setting up the very first Catholic, I guess they call it a parish, in Rutherford County, there was a great deal of concern. There was marches. There was protest, you'd call mm-hmm. it. They persisted, and, you know, now St. Rose of Lima is, mm-hmm. you know, a stalwart part of our religious community. But we resist when we don't understand frequently. And that, of course, was during the period back in the 19-teens, 1920s, when there was a big European, Eastern European, Mediterranean, European immigration. And that really was what was the concern, I think, was you know, all these new people coming into the area. And I know I have read some of the tracts and such that were written objecting to the Catholics, and the real objection was, how can these people be loyal Americans if they have an earthly loyalty to something that looks an awful lot like a king in Italy, mm-hmm. referencing, of course, the Pope and the Vatican.
You remember in the early 1960s when we had a presidential race,
that was
right at the forefront.
Right, and I think that pretty much closed it, too.
Yeah.
Once we saw that our president was our president first, and, you know, his personal beliefs, whatever they were secondary to his duty there. So
it's amazing how our fears will overcome our rational thinking sometimes.
Yeah. One of my favorite points that we closed on was when the Murphree sisters. Now, some of your listeners may be aware that one of our most prominent authors in the past was Mary Noelle's, spelled curiously, Murphree, a direct mm-hmm. descendant of Colonel Hardy Murphree.
We followed her in grade school.
Yeah.
Yes.
And she wrote under a pseudonym, mm-hmm. Egbert Craddock. But she and her sister in the late 1800s apparently decided that, and you can tell your readers, your listeners, I'm smiling, that the Presbyterians were just getting too darn common. Too many hoi polloi in the Presbyterian church, and they needed a more...
Wait a minute. How can you be too common and be a hoi polloi at the same time? I don't understand that.
Look it up. but they decided that they needed to bring in what's called the high church, high church. In fact, a direct connection with the old Anglican Church of England, the Episcopalians. And they started the Episcopalian congregation. But what I thought was amusing was they started it in the old Odd Fellows Hall, which was virtually vacant at that period. The Odd Fellows had moved on. But they acquired that building and had their church there. It was on Spring Street. Then they acquired the property, properly situated for a high-status church on East Main.
Mm-hmm.
And they jacked up the building over on Spring Street, put logs and rollers under it, rolled it out onto East Main, rolled it up the street, and set it in place, which I thought certainly established them as the first holy rollers in Murfreesboro.
That did bring a chuckle to the crowd.
That was interesting. And, of course, the Methodists, when they first came in, were called the Shouting Methodists because they also, and it's interesting to read, like John Spence in his description of the Methodist, a very conservative, sedate in dress and style and speech and manner in their daily dealings. But when they got rolling on Sunday, there was an awful lot of shouting going on. And that, I think, has been a tradition through a lot of Southern religion. It can be very emotional. And that you let those emotions be seen and be known, you know, during that.
That's commonplace in a lot of churches, even today.
Yeah, I think so.
And people just get caught up in the spirit, and then they go accordingly.
Yeah. You know, we were talking about things we would not have anticipated. When I was young, there were Methodists, there were Presbyterians, and there were a few that were smaller, some of the evangelicals. But the concept of a non-denominational church, you know, I don't remember even anybody ever suggesting that, you know, let's...
Don't remember anything like that.
No. Now, that's probably the biggest growing segment of our active church community now, beginning with in the smaller communities, what we call the community churches, like down in Hoover's Gap, where there used to be the separate, you know, congregations, for reasons of size perhaps, you have what they call community churches, which have kind of melded some of the, but then we've got these tremendous congregations, very enthusiastic and prosperous, that are at world outreach. You have to admire any program that can attract that many adherents.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, just thousands of people. And I remember that if you just track the growth of denominations, the non-denominational churches are just way ahead in the last decade. As our styles and our interests and our whatever changes, the churches change, you know, to meet it. And again, I think that's a good thing.
Well, I remember my mother letting me go to Vacation Bible School at another denomination, a Baptist church. And I remember coming home because they had asked if any of us wanted to be baptized. And my mother was irate because there I was, Church of Christ and the Baptist, which I go to a Baptist now. But it was interesting to her reaction because she didn't want me going back there. And I thought that was, you know.
Right.
Everybody to you know, has their own special interest in church and what they want out of it.
Right.
But you know, and this is getting away from the subject. You and I have a way of doing this, and I'm usually the one that steers it all over the place.
I just try to keep it in a historical perspective.
and let's do. Your story the other day about 1942, the class of 42.
Class of 42.
Was one of the more interesting things I have read, simply because of the impact on those particular people at that time. I mean, we had just gotten into a major world war, World War II.
Well, when they started, which of course was September 41, you know, we weren't there.
Right.
And I don't think any high school senior beginning their year you know, anticipates that things are going to be that different.
Mm-hmm.
You know you're going to graduate and it's time to make the transition into another phase of your life. But to have everything just turned topsy-turvy, just turned over, you know, in the midst of that, what an experience. That article, or articles like that, always I enjoy, because the real point of even writing about a period like that is to talk about what was going on in that period so people can remember and recognize how different life was. Mm-hmm. In so many ways. And for example, if you look at the papers in the late 30s and even the newspaper, the newspaper in Murfreesboro, on the week of that school year beginning,
mm-hmm.
has on the front page stories about a very scary fear back then, which was polio.
Right.
And concurrent with the beginning of the school year was the first reported death for that year from polio, a child out in Halls Hill.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time that the school was starting here at Central, the community, it's called Cemetery Community, primarily a black community out near what's now the National Cemetery, the old battlefield, was under quarantine. I mean, there's a lot of people, young people today, the concept of a quarantine probably, you know, would be hard to understand, but they literally, the local health department goes out and puts a sign on your door that says quarantine, and you don't get out and nobody comes in until the cause of the quarantine. Well, polio was so scary that they essentially quarantined the community.
Mm-hmm.
Because they felt like before they had recognized the case out there, and there was a severe case among the children there, a significant number of the other children in the neighborhood had been exposed. Mm-hmm. Now, back then, they didn't really understand what polio was about or how it spread. So the community was under quarantine. And here we are at Central High School planning our sports and our dances in that context.
And you and I, it was primarily a hot weather disease, if I remember
right. It seemed to, and of course the suspicion, which I think had some bearing, was that the hot weather insects, like flies,
mm-hmm.
could transmit the disease.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know whether that was correct or not, but that was one of the things that we worried about. Or bad water. And you know how the water in the creeks then and now in August, of course now the weather's so confused, I don't know what's going to happen in August.
No.
But
I was telling you a story earlier, I think I told you, that Jake's Avenue, Jakestown, we all went to Halls Hill and had a picnic and swam. All the kids and parents were there.
Mm-hmm.
And had a great time. And on our way back, I think it was maybe the next day, some of us started getting sick.
Oh, my.
And the Bensons, who a brother and a sister, they got the brunt of it. And Barbara, I mean, she really had a hard time with polio. But the rest of us, it just seemed like it, sometimes I guess you just maybe just get a smattering of something, and it just makes you sick, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
But it was on a hot day. We were all out there. And I can remember even when they closed the state fair down, because they thought that would be a major contributor,
right,
to it spreading at that time.
Because you'd have so many people together, which,
right,
reminds me a little beyond Rutherford County, but the Boy Scouts were very prominent in Rutherford County during the 30s,
mm-hmm.
and throughout the country, and that continued on through the war. The Boy Scouts really carried a lot of responsibility then. But with respect to polio, the Boy Scouts planned their first national encampment, you'd call it. First time we're going to bring scouts together from all over the United States in one place.
Mm-hmm.
The place was going to be the mall in Washington, D.C. And as they were doing their advanced planning, someone wisely said, well, in case of some disaster, including our inability to hold it for some reason and canceling, we got a lot of money we're going to put into it. They took out an insurance policy, which essentially provided that, protect against liability, but it would reimburse the scout organization for its losses if, because of circumstances beyond the control of the scout organization,
mm-hmm.
The jamboree didn't happen.
Wow.
Well, as the time of the Jamboree approached, it was 1937 summer was when it was planned. Early in that year or late the year before, it began to be evident that because of the fears of polio, there was not going to be the turnout, the participation. In other words, the parents and the scout leaders locally were afraid to risk bringing all the kids together in what would have been the hot part of summer on the mall because of the fears of a polio epidemic, an outbreak or something like that. Well, that was speculation. And if the scouts canceled the Jamboree on that speculation, they would have had to take all the loss. And it shows the clever organization and also the influence the Boy Scouts had at that time. Through their Washington contacts, they got an audience with President Roosevelt, explained to him the concern. And as they hoped, the president issued an order forbidding and prohibiting a gathering of Boy Scouts on the mall because of the risk that had been identified by the National Institutes of Health or whoever he relied upon.
Of course, he had been a victim of polio
himself. Yeah, he was. He was handicapped himself for polio. And he issued the order, which was obviously beyond the control of the Scouts. They were able to collect their insurance. But, you know, illustrates what a fear that was. And
it was totally disabilitating. If you actually had a full strand of polio, I mean, it would absolutely just wipe you out. I mean, we all remember the big fear was being put in an iron lung, and so many people had that.
Well, in our generation, I'm sure you went to school with some too. I can remember several children in my classes through 12 years that had polio and were partially handicapped. And some very slightly. There could be mild cases. In the severe cases, the polio paralyzed the diaphragm. So, you know, they couldn't breathe. And that's why you and I remember the pictures. I never saw anybody in one personally, but I can certainly remember pictures where you're in what looks like a great big metal barrel. And inside there, they're using a vacuum of compression, I guess, to breathe, you know, to cause you to breathe. And I mean, what kind of life did you look forward to? You know, you were dependent on being on your back in a big metal barrel, you know, for the rest of your life. So.
Yeah, devastating. And you mentioned earlier that the last iron lung victim just
within the
passed
last
away.
Year. And of course,
that's amazing they lived that long.
Over the years, they were no longer in the big, you know, the technology, and they were able to use, but the last individual who was actually in the old iron lung for a while just recently died, which defied all odds because it was taken for granted that the polio children, if they survived the disease onset, you know, would not live a full lifetime.
But can you imagine? Well, I guess I can imagine. I believe we're going to have to take a quick break, and we'll take a quick break and be right back with Greg Tucker and the Greg Tucker Show.
Hi, I'm Dr. Michael Jordan, an orthopedic surgeon with Middle Tennessee Medical Center. As the official health care providers of the MTSU Blue Raiders, we know the importance of getting players healthy and back in the game. Middle Tennessee Medical Center provides comprehensive orthopedic care with expertise to return each patient to an active and functional lifestyle. Our team is highly experienced in orthopedic and joint replacement surgery, which means better outcomes and quicker recoveries. To make an appointment with an MTMC orthopedic specialist, call 615-284-BONE.
This Memorial Day weekend, May 26th through 28th, the Murfreesboro Noon Exchange Club presents the 4th Annual Healing Field, Flags of Remembrance, on Medical Center Parkway next to Belk. You can sponsor a flag in memory or in honor of any hero in your life for just $30 by calling 615-641-0121. Make this Memorial Day meaningful by sponsoring or visiting this year's Healing Field.
This is Good Neighbor Events, brought to you by the Omni Hut Restaurant in Smyrna, AmeriCare Pest Control, and the Rutherford Home Show, Saturday mornings at 11:30 on WGNS.
If you're planning to buy a home, choose a professional that will look out for you. Anhook & Associates has a proven track record of helping guide clients through the home buying experience. Whether buying your first home, moving up, downsizing, or investing, Ann's team will help you do it right. When it's your time to buy or sell, just ask Ann.
This is Ann Hoke at Keller Williams Realty. I would love to personally talk with you. Call me today at 397-4024. Sell faster and buy smarter with Ann Hoke & Associates.
Well, here it is, Tuesday, May the 8th, and there are two GED adult classes this evening, both of them at 6 o'clock. One of them's at the Patterson Community Center at 521 Mercury Boulevard. The other's at the City Schools Family Learning Center at 607 Bridge Avenue, and childcare is provided at both locations. For information about these GED adult classes, call 893-7439. Tonight's the final night for auditions for the musical 13 at the Center for the Arts in Uptown Murfreesboro. That'll be from 6:30 until 9 tonight, and they're at 110 West College Street. Be sure and wear comfortable clothing and shoes, no flip-flops. For information, call 904-2787. Grace Fest is tonight at the Fellowship United Methodist Church at 2511 the Salem Highway, and that's near Cason Lane. 7 o'clock tonight. The Grace Fest Praise Team opens at 7, followed by the Sidewalk Prophets. This is a free concert, but a love offering will be taken to benefit the Journey Home and Greenhouse Ministries. That's tonight. The play, The Fantastic Mr. Fox, tomorrow night and Thursday night at Bradley Academy. Those are Good Neighbor events.
Projects help!
Those are the children of Project Help. Saddle Up for Project Help will be held Thursday, July 26th at 6:30 p.m. Proceeds benefit Project Help, Rutherford County's only center-based early intervention preschool program. To sponsor Saddle Up, buy tickets or learn more about Project Help, call 898-2458 or visit mtsu.edu/Project Help.
Did you realize we have 10 items at the Maple Street Grill for lunch under $6.99? Hi, this is Mike from Maple Street Grill. Debbie and I wanted to invite you down to try some of the exciting new menu items. 10 items at the Maple Street Grill for lunch under $6.99. Maple Street Grill, 109 North Maple Street in the historic downtown Murfreesboro area.
He knows Rutherford County, and he knows the people of Rutherford County. Truman Jones, here on WGNS AM and FM.
And welcome back with Greg Tucker, and want to let you know that this portion of his show is brought to you by At Home Care, Melissa Warren's business. They come into your home, take care of all of your responsibilities, and if it looks like that you may have to move out because you can no longer take care of those tasks, you don't have to. All you have to do is give them a call at 713-4639 or pull them up on the internet, www.athomecaretennessee.com, and they'll come in 24/7, take care of all of those duties for you, make sure that your home is still going to remain your castle, and all you have to do is just sit back and enjoy it. And I tell you what, if you'll give that number a call, 713-4639, you'll be awfully glad you did. Well, let's see. We're still in 1942.
Well, again, parallels with the day. There are lawsuits, trials that some of us follow with interest.
Really?
Yeah, and some you wish we didn't have to hear about. But when I was reading during that week that school was starting back in 1941, the entire legal community was watching very closely the Fish Fry case, which is a good example, I think, of kind of overzealous lawmakers. Apparently there had been some concern about the illegal taking of game and fish, poaching as we would call it, and they had amended the game laws so that anyone using a fish or fowl or deer or whatever that had been illegally taken would be held to the same penalties.
Now, illegally taken, that means without a license or what?
Or by a method that was prohibited.
Okay.
Okay. And, you know, they had in place at the time, in fact, going way back to the turn of the 20th century, they had in place, you know, fines for shooting out of season or, you know, shooting protected species and such. Well, the law that had been passed had said not only the one who, you know, commits the illegal act of the poaching, but anyone who then uses the, you might say, the fruits or the flesh of, mm-hmm. of that activity would be held to the same fine. One of the county commissioners decided to have essentially a political rally, and it was an election year, at his farm, and he invited another one of the commissioners with the understanding that you provide the fish, and you know, I'll provide.
You sure we're not talking about Davidson County and the sheriff's department there?
I remember some of this too. But no, this is back. This is right here, right here. Well, it turns out that the fish that were brought in by one of the county commissioners mm-hmm. had been seined out of the Stonehenge River. Oh, my goodness.
That's terrible.
Yeah, and seining was an illegal way of taking game fish.
I hope they didn't catch any snail darters.
At the time. you know, there was some good fishing in the Stones River back then.
Some real good fishing. Real I good can attest fishing. To that.
Yeah, well, they had seined it. And so the fish that were being fried were illegally taken. Mm-hmm. Charges were brought, and again, it was you know, some political trying to embarrass there, because just about everybody there was a county commissioner or mm-hmm. a county officer or something like that. Well, they charged the fella with illegally seining, and then they charged his wife because she cooked the fish.
Oh, no.
That's illegal use of illegally taken game, see? So they charged her with the same fines and such. Mm-hmm. And then several of the commissioners, naturally, mm-hmm. ate the fish. And that also was deemed to be using the illegally taken game. And charges were brought.
And now, would you hate to be the district attorney at that time?
He was apparently under some pressure, political pressure mm-hmm. to go forward with it, because, well, it turned into a big affair. And one of the commissioners hired Clarence Cummings.
Oh, yes.
Yes. In that period, one of the most colorful and successful criminal defense attorneys.
Super nice guy.
And a nice guy. Yeah. And I think he had some contacts in the legislature, mm-hmm. if I remember right.
Quite a few
direct family contacts. He announced that this was a persecution, not a prosecution, and guaranteed that if his client, who was guilty of eating fish that had been cooked by an illegal cook because they were illegally seined, if his client was found guilty, he would take it all the way to the state Supreme Court. It was not going to let this lie. They had the trial in September 1941, mm-hmm. and it says the reports indicate that every member of the bar, all the attorneys in town, were there, either representing one or the other commissioner or observing. It turned into a circus, as you could imagine. Two very raucous days of trial mm-hmm. testimony and all. The judge was probably did exactly the right thing. After 2 days of circus atmosphere, he declared a mistrial. And essentially, a mistrial means we're not going to come to a decision here. And if the prosecution wants to start over at some later time, they'll have to start over. And this is just a waste of time, and it's out. I've been in a few mistrials, and
don't you know CNN would have loved to be there.
Yeah,
kind of like almost like the Scopes trial, but just different.
Yeah, I have not been able to find any time when the charges were brought up for a second trial. I think the judge's message was this should not be in court, and he threw it out. And apparently, sometime later, we haven't run it down, but I suspect the law, because what it did, it demonstrated the fact that this has gone too far. Mm-hmm. You know, if we've all got to be on such caution, particularly back then, as to what's the history of what we're eating, or we're going to be set, you know.
Well, now, you're a famous attorney. I mean, you've practiced law in some of the, you never retire as an attorney. You practice laws in some of the most important venues, and the laws that are set up by each state, the governments are each state. Don't you find that a lot of those laws, if it wasn't for special events that had occurred, kind of like the knee-jerk type situation, a lot of those laws wouldn't even be on the book now?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In fact, when you come across a quirk or an unusual, you can trace it back usually, and something out of the ordinary or something, you know, that really offended the conscience, the public conscience, mm-hmm. you know, and we say that circumstances like that make for bad law. Fortunately, prosecutors, and remember we've talked before about prosecutorial discretion, those who are charged with, as public servants, bringing and enforcing the law, they have a lot of discretion.
Mm-hmm.
And in many cases, their discretion is not to bring the case. In some jurisdictions, you still are subject to a fine for spitting on the sidewalk, just to use an easy example. And no prosecutor is going to, you know, use public time and you know, to pursue those kind of things. But somewhere along the line, somebody spit tobacco in the wrong place and offended somebody, and so you get a law.
Emotions and prejudices are so apparent in laws.
Yeah.
And I found that over the years. And we have been so blessed here in Rutherford County that I've known the last three DAs that we have had, district attorneys, and all the judges, and I can tell you that justice has been pure here in Rutherford County as far as I can remember, because common sense and a thought of the well-being of the citizens in this community have always been at the forefront, and you don't see that everywhere else. And mm-hmm. we've been so lucky to have that here.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when Bill Weiss, of course, is a DA now, and Guy Dyson before him. You go back to Wally Holloway. We've just been blessed here. I mean, just the top-notch guys.
And usually those are what we'd call low-profile
right.
offices. Most people in the county couldn't name our district attorney. But,
and couldn't tell you what their responsibilities
yeah,
are.
Yeah, and probably don't understand just what. You know, the simple point that in a crime, the victims don't prosecute. You know, there has to be a prosecution by the sovereign,
mm-hmm.
and that's the role of the district attorney and his people. Another thing that was interesting to go back and look at, you know, a fixed period in the early 40s are interesting because we've still got a lot of people around the neighborhood, the communities, that remember that time
mm-hmm.
and enjoy being reminded, but also their sources. The businesses of the time, just going through business directories back then, the oldest business identified in 1941 in the county, still under basically the same ownership, same family, was Jackson Brothers.
Wow.
It started in Eagleville
uh-huh.
and started before there were automobiles to be sold. They were selling more like what we'd call hardware, farm implement, that kind of thing. And mm-hmm. it evolved, moved from Eagleville to Murfreesboro. And, of course, you and I remember Jackson Brothers Chevrolet.
Oh, yes, very well.
That was the oldest business at the time. Woodfin and Moore, which started about 1909, I believe, was mm-hmm. among the oldest businesses. And at the time, Bell Jewelers was one of the two or three oldest. Bell Jewelers is still, as far as I know, owned by the same family.
That's amazing.
And they've relocated, of course, off the square.
So what would they have been, about 10 years ahead of, say, Mullins or
more than that.
More than that.
More than that. I believe they come from in the teens, 19-teens.
Okay. All right. Yeah,
Mullins set up in the late 30s because mm-hmm. he was repairing watches before he got pulled
That's
into
right.
the defense industry.
Right.
Holden Hardware is another, you know, classic early business, but they were after the war when mm-hmm. The senior Holden came back from the military. About 48, I think he announced his own business. But I would guess that Woodfin's Funeral Home and Bell Jewelers are probably, and I couldn't swear which is the oldest. Actually, I think Bell Jewelers may be, I may be wrong, they may be pre-20th century. But those would be two of the oldest. And, of course, they've gone through changes. Woodfin and Moore is, mm-hmm. is, you know, under a different name now. But
You're talking about two businesses that would have been totally disrupted by the war.
Yeah.
Because you were talking about most of the males
Absolutely.
During that period.
Oh, yeah.
We're going to war,
mm-hmm.
either volunteering or what. In fact, as you were saying earlier, most of them did volunteer to go.
Right. And if you'll go back and look at the classifieds or the ads in the early 40s as the war is just kind of building, you'll see businesses offered for sale. And they will say, you know, I've been drafted or I'm volunteering or something or another and I'm having to leave, and they're liquidating a business. Mm-hmm. In some cases, a good business. Because first the uncertainty of, you know, when's this going to be over, when we're going to be back, and the lack of anybody to step in and pick it up because most of the young men were going. We were talking earlier about, obviously, there was a draft, but in the first year or so after Pearl Harbor, the attack on Pearl Harbor, there were waves and waves of young men volunteering. Mm-hmm. So the draft didn't become that important a factor until, you know, later in the war. Again, a contrast with today. We rely on volunteers again, but it's not, well, I'm sure that we're motivated by patriotism, but also it's a good job sometimes. Mm-hmm. And then I don't think anybody thought this was going to be a good job because we had been attacked. And
well, but you got all these young men, 18, 19 years old, mm-hmm. that have got their lives in front of them and looking forward to a career, and then all of a sudden mm-hmm. they throw it all aside for the good of the country, right. And there they go.
Right. December 7th was labeled by our president as the Day of Infamy, mm-hmm. but for those young people, it was the next day that really changed their lives, because about noon on December 8th, Roosevelt announced that Congress had declared war. And that meant, you know, we know where we're going. And it was the December 10th that war was declared on Germany. So in a period of about 3 days there, you know, we opened up both theaters of war.
I believe we have a caller on the line, Greg. Caller, welcome aboard.
Hello. Yeah. It's your buddy again. No need to identify the speaker, but I just want to say thank you, Greg, for what you did. Prayer breakfast, and Homer Pittard would be very proud of you. That's all I've got to say.
Well, I've thought many times how I'd like to sit down with Homer and talk through some of those things where he and I have come to different conclusions, but also to have the benefit of his perspective and insight as one of our biggest contributing historians for the local community.
And we're going to have to take a quick break, but before we go, we want to let you know that this portion of the show is brought to you by Gordon Ralston Photography at 315 Hickerson Drive, and you can reach them at 396-8776 or on the internet, www.gordonralstonphoto.com. And speaking of history, these guys go back a long way in Rutherford County. Born and raised here, Al Gordon, a master craftsman photographer, and Larry Ralston, a certified craftsman, are the most awarded studio in the Middle Tennessee area, operating a full-service photographic studio in Murfreesboro. They specialize in weddings, high school seniors, and family portraits. Their work is classic yet current with a creative edge. Al was even awarded the Grand Award for the best wedding image in the world. Gordon Ralston, they look forward to meeting you and will treat you like family.
No, it's symbolic of you tossing your hat into the ring.
You're just graduating, not running for office.
Dad, why do college graduates toss their caps into the sky?
Actually, it started in the Navy when midshipmen became officers.
This May, thousands of Hope Scholars will toss their caps into the sky. And with over $2.3 billion raised for education by the Tennessee Lottery, that's a lot of winners.
You'll learn something new every day.
I knew it all along.
Congratulations, Hope Scholars. For information about scholarships and grants, visit seehowitaddsup.com.
I think they were originally made of sheepskin.
Actually, I think it was parchment.
Dad, why do they call diplomas sheepskins?
Well, in the old days, paper was brittle, but parchment made from sheepskin was used because it lasted longer.
This May, thousands of Hope Scholars will receive college diplomas. And with over $2.3 billion raised for education by the Tennessee Lottery, we've taken higher education even higher.
How'd you get to be so smart, Dad?
I had a scholarship.
Congratulations, Hope Scholars. For information about scholarships and grants, visit seehowitaddsup.com.
We're at the Garden Patch Thrift Store on Spring Street across from the tall NHC building, talking with Christy Sanford.
Instead of it just being rows and rows of just shirts and pants, we try to make it more in sections, so we'll have like a houseware section, and we try to set up more display areas.
Donations to the Garden Patch Thrift Store and proceeds from sales help fund Greenhouse Ministries, a faith-based nonprofit helping underserved in our community.
We are located at 309 South Spring Street,
across from the tall NHC building.
Take your family to Franklin Road Baptist Church this Sunday.
Franklin Road Baptist Church youth pastor Kurt Copeland says that teenagers are our future.
Hello, my name is Kurt Copeland. I'm the youth pastor at Franklin Road Baptist Church. Teenagers, teenagers, teenagers. That's the future of America, and that's the future of our church.
Sunday school, 10 a.m., morning worship, 11, and evening worship at 6:30.
It is wonderful to know that a teenager can develop a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. Now, we pack our calendar full of great activities, but the thrust of our youth ministry is the preaching of God's Word and personal soul winning. There's nothing better than to see a teenager trust Jesus Christ as their personal Savior, then to surrender to God's will, and then to begin a life living for Jesus Christ.
Franklin Road Baptist Church, down the street from Kaysen Lane on Highway 96, which is also known as Franklin Road in Murfreesboro.
He knows Rutherford County's past, and his wisdom can give good insight into our future. It's the Truman Show. Here again, Truman Jones.
And welcome back with Greg Tucker. We have a caller that has called and said that they think that Bell Jewelry opened in 1874, which would be probably much earlier than anything else.
I wouldn't argue with that, because I know it was before the turn of the century.
Uh-huh.
And I think generally believe that that's the oldest continuous business in the county right now.
You know what's amazing about Eagleville? They seem to have a lot of businesses that last forever to start right in downtown Eagleville. Because we all remember Crossland Supply, which was a major supplier for this area for many, many years.
And, you know, that's one of them I'm almost sure that almost liquidated, because the younger Crosslands were going into the service. We can check that, but they all
that was during that particular time period?
During the World War II period. But I believe Jackson Brothers might still, and while they were still here and owned by the same family and descendants, may predate Bell still. We'll look at that, because they were selling harnesses and farm stuff for the animal power period long before they got into the cars and such. But on a lighter note, let me ask you, because I know you're such an authority on old Westerns.
Oh, here we go.
You know Tim McCoy?
You always set me up.
Do you remember any Tim McCoy movies?
I remember watching Tim McCoy at the Princess Theater, yes.
Well, that's exactly what was on at the Roxy.
Uh-huh. I couldn't go to the Roxy.
We won't get into that.
No.
But Tim McCoy was playing in Six Gun Trail at the Roxy.
Oh, one of my all-time favorites.
Well, the serial at the time, this was the matinee for the kids,
mm-hmm.
was the last chapter of The Spider Returns. I have no idea what that was about.
Now, that one doesn't compute at all.
I don't remember that one.
I remember we do the Flash Gordon type movies.
I remember all those.
Yeah, and you remember how they would always leave you hanging at the end, so you had to come the next Saturday.
Right.
So you come the next Saturday, and you'll see half of that movie again.
They overlap. I actually
they figured, saved a lot of money, didn't they?
Yeah, it seems like if you went to every other one, you would have had the you would have had the whole story.
And poor George Reeves was Superman, as you remember.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw how they did it. He would lay out prone, and then they'd have a big wind machine that would be blowing him in. And it looked so real, but now if you can find some of those old Superman movies, they're terrible.
Yeah, the TV is what I remember of Superman, and they always started with that, with his cape blowing,
mm-hmm.
such as that. Let's see.
More trivia.
Yeah, well, what was playing over at the Prince's? I believe it was a John Wayne. I actually made some notes when I was going through.
How about they were expendable about that time?
Yeah, John Wayne. Oh, it was his movie about the Ozarks. What was the name of that movie?
Shepherd of the Hills. Yes. Harry Carey Sr. was his dad in that movie.
Yeah, I remember it well.
I think Beulah Bondi was in that movie also, and she may have been his mother, I think.
May have been. It's John Wayne seems to go back so far, you know. Recently watching an old Western John Wayne. He was such a kid, tall, skinny.
Oh, yeah.
And I can see where, you know, he was the heartthrob back in those
days. His first big movie actually was in 1939, Stagecoach. That's the one that made him.
Yeah, well, he was apparently doing what we'd call B-stuff.
Yeah, he did all B-stuff up at that time.
Yeah.
In fact, he played football a little bit for USC, I think. And he and Ward Bond, if I'm not mistaken, were on the same team back then.
Is that right?
Yeah.
If you watch some of the B stuff, he's doing his own stunts in almost all of that. And he never gets on the horse one leg at a time. He springs onto it, either over the haunches of the horse or hits the ground, you know, where they grab the saddle horn, hits the ground, and bounces up onto it.
Nobody rode a horse unless they were after somebody or trying to get away from somebody.
That's true. And everybody in the movies were good horsemen, because you watch those old, you know, they're tearing around. There's no fake scenes there. They're actually doing it.
Tom Mix was, you know, he was kind of the start of all that. He had a horse named Tony. He was pretty tough.
The Marilyn Monroe movie at the, I believe it was bus stop, where they had scenes of the rodeo. I watched them film that. We were in Phoenix at the time. And they come tearing down through the center of the rodeo field with a pickup truck with the saddle mounted on the back of it and the camera up on the front of it. Kind of hurt me to see that. I thought all that stuff back then was for real.
Was it because we were so young we just didn't know any better? Because I never could understand.
I think we wanted to believe.
Yeah. Because, you know, there's an old movie, and you've seen it a lot of times just like I have, called Bringing Up Baby.
Oh, yeah.
Cary Grant and Katharine Hepburn, and that leopard is sitting behind them in a car. And every once in a while, if you use sharp eyes, you can see that leopard is not actually in that car with them. And that does. It kind of breaks your heart a little bit. And just kind of the same kind of feeling I get when Brian brings that little placard up, says "Wrap Up Show," because it's one of the most fun hours I ever have with you, Greg. Because I learn a lot, and it's actually extremely entertaining. And I'm going to tell. Am I off the air, Brian?
He's walked out of the room. Maybe we're going to do a second hour here.
Are we going to do a second hour? No, he's telling me to shut up. So. We'll see you guys Thursday. Thank you, Greg. It's always fun to have you here. And I'm going to turn it over to Brian.